Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Kumar Parkala, KPMG Head of IT Advisory, EMA in India, Chief Operating Officer, Advisory India, an internationally renowned innovator and senior executive. Kumar, you bring a substantive history of significant and considerable international contribution to innovation, executive leadership, and industry to this interview. We are very fortunate to have you come in today where you can share your experiences with the audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Kumar, you have this amazing, remarkable background, probably, you know, just really one of the most internationally renowned executives out there in terms of what you've done, and you've done it all. And it was a real pleasure to talk with you at the World Computing Congress held in Brisbane, Australia in September. And I just wanted to congratulate you on your many remarkable achievements.
Thank you, Stephen. I feel very privileged to have received the award at the World Computer Congress.
Kumar, can you tell us more about your work now with the Global Clinton Initiative and the Jet Li Foundation?
Sure, Stephen. As many of your listeners would be aware of, President Bill Clinton established in 2005 the Global Clinton Initiative. And since its inception, CGI's members have helped more than 16 million women and girls to have access to empowered initiatives. There are about 10 million people who have improved their access to capital and financial services. Nearly 5 million people have obtained access to information technology, and commitments valued in excess of $63 billion have been made. I've been very fortunate to have been invited by President Clinton to be a part of this initiative, and I am continuing to support various activities of CGI, including a forum to engage with college students in global citizenship, or commitments to action, and various other philanthropic activities. So I feel very, very privileged to be associated with CGI. The Red Cross Society of China Jet Li One Foundation was founded by Jet Li, which many of your listeners would know from his movies in Hollywood. And again, I was invited by Jet Li to participate in the foundation. And the main purpose of the foundation is to support various philanthropic and humanitarian activities around the world, starting with China and other countries. And very importantly, the Jet Li Foundation did a huge amount of work in the disaster relief in China. And again, I've been invited by the foundation to participate in the forum. And we from KPMG are trying to contribute to this great initiative in whichever way we can.
Well, Kumar, I just really want to commend you on the tremendous work that you're doing with these initiatives. And I know that your background and your reach would be deeply appreciated by these initiatives and foundations. Now, we're going to now look back over your early years. What triggered your initial interest in technology, and then what forces shaped your interests?
I actually got into the technology space very accidentally. I finished up at my university studies late 80s, and I actually finished my degree in economics. I happened to do a few subjects in computing. And at that time, it was around 89, 90, the whole computer age was starting up in India. And I got an opportunity to work on some of the very interesting projects. Very importantly, after working for 1 year, I got an opportunity to travel to Australia. I happened to go to a small town called Rockhampton, and that was the town where there were a number of people who were using computers. They bought computers, but they didn't really know how to use those computers. So I became a small entrepreneur in a way to earn money for myself, to support my education, at the same time help these people get more out of their computers. One thing led to another, and I became a computer professional in that town. I started training people in the mines. Rockhampton is surrounded by one of the largest mines in the world, so I used to go to these mines and train people in how to use computers. And then I started working with the university, and one after another, I moved on to managing computer systems. I became a CIO after several years of work in the industry with Queensland government, and of course I joined ACS and eventually became president. So I accidentally got into the technology. Then I worked through various opportunities that came my way, and I persevered, and ultimately I had a very rewarding career in IT spanning more than 20 years.
Well, that's really a fascinating kind of history in terms of how you got into computers. And, you know, in your answer, you mentioned the ACS, and that's the Australian Computer Society. So getting to the Australian Computer Society, what lessons can you share from your positions as national chairman of the ACS and regular columnist for the Australian?
Stephen, as you know, ACS is one of the well-recognized professional bodies of the world in information technology. ACS has close to 16,500 members. And at the end of 2007, I was very fortunate to be elected as the national chairman of ACS by these members. And since then, in that role, I became the spokesperson for one of the spokesperson for the IT community in Australia and the industry. And the main purpose of the society is to advance professionalism, ICT professionalism, and that is what ACS is well known for. And in my columns in the Australian, which I've written over a period of 2 years, I have always emphasized on the benefits of using technology, and more importantly, the governments around the world to have a vision as far as their technology strategy is concerned, because technology is a major enabler of increasing productivity and ultimately creating national wealth. So my columns in the Australian were regularly focused on how the government should make technology a strategic national priority. And more importantly, what the governments around the world and the industry should be doing, particularly in Australia and other countries, to leverage information technology and create sustainable wealth for its people.
So from your current roles, what do you hope to achieve, and how do you bring value to your stakeholders?
Steve and I work for the professional services firm KPMG, which you are well aware of, is a global organization. And I have currently two roles. One role is that of being the head of IT advisory for Europe, Middle East, Africa, and India business for KPMG. And in that role, we are actually looking at how we can help our clients particularly at the CEO and CFO level, address their requirements for technology solutions. We don't go out there and sell technology products, but we are the trusted advisors to the CFOs and CEOs in the space of technology. So all large corporations and businesses of the world, and many government organizations as well, they use our people to ensure that they are getting value from their technology investments and that they are embarking on projects that are going to be meaningful, can be delivered on time, and that ultimately they're able to drive their business using technology as an enabler. And that's where KPMG helps them to come up with innovative ways of what they can do with the existing and emerging technologies, help them grow their businesses further. So that's what I do in my role as the head of IT advisory. I also got another role, and that is of being a chief operating officer for our advisory business in India. And it's a very exciting business that we have in India. We have 5,000 people in the organization, of which more than half are in our advisory business. We have a business that is growing very, very rapidly, to the tune of 40 to 50% in some areas. And it is extremely, it's a great privilege, and I feel that it's an extremely good marketplace right now that is emerging in India compared to the rest of the world. And that is what keeps professionals like me motivated to meet the demands of our clients in emerging markets. And my role in advisory is very much focused on helping create a team of strong advisors who are able to help our clients in the area of transaction and restructuring, in the area of performance and technology, and in the areas of risk and compliance. So that is the second part of our business that I focus on.
So in these roles, then, you would probably have deep personal relationships with senior executives through these regions.
Yes, Stephen. I've been very fortunate, actually, to be able to build very good relationships and, in fact, friendships with many successful, well-known professionals of the world. They're not only from the IT industry or professional services. I've been very fortunate to build relationships with people from all industries, and I feel that, again, there was always so much to learn, and I continue to learn when I meet with some of these people on a day-to-day basis. And again, to be in that position, I feel very fortunate.
Kumar, looking at your remarkable career successes, what are your most difficult challenges, past, present, and future?
I had a remarkable learning experience in my career over the last 20-odd years, Stephen. And I've been in situations where I can say in the past where there was very little I could do in terms of helping the organization address those issues, such as a downturn in the economic situation, or changes in the labor market which impact businesses. Or more importantly, very recently, I've been working with organizations where they have had impact of a global financial crisis, which is sometimes nothing to do with what they have done. They just get impacted. All these experiences have taught me to become flexible in my thinking, adaptable, embrace change, and as a result of that, I have now built in myself an ability to be resilient in situations which are unpredictable and difficult. But you can never avoid facing challenging moments. They happen to you on a daily basis, especially if you're running a business that has a large number of people. Whatever impacts those people impacts you, and I think if you are having enough empathy, then you know, sometimes you come across challenging situations where you may have good people, extremely good people, but may or may not be performing that well, and you may have to take action. So those are the kind of situations which are very, very difficult from a humanistic point of view. And yes, dealing with systems and computers is relatively a lot more easier than dealing with people. And I'm still getting better at connecting with people, improving my style of leadership, improving my emotional intelligence, and driving a business that needs to continue to grow in an economy that is growing extremely fast. And again, to meet those expectations, Stephen, that people would have in a fast-growing economy as far as the growth of the business and the targets you set yourself, it could become very challenging. So those are some of my challenges, if I can say so. And I'm enjoying the challenge. I'm learning on a daily basis as we go. But nevertheless, it is a challenging experience.
Now, Kumar, can you provide your career highlights and valuable lessons you wish to share with the audience?
Sure, Stephen. I had many career highlights. I had a great deal of fun as I progressed in my career over the last 20 years. And the career highlights that I remember are the times when I had a great time working with people and working for organizations, large organizations, of course, in Australia and overseas. One of the highlights of my career was when I joined the Queensland government in mid-90s, and when I finished up in the year 2000, I was very fortunate to get the Leadership Excellence Award from the government. And as an IT professional, it was a great accolade for me because I was the first professional to be recognized with a leadership award, which would usually go to the business people of the government. When I say the business people, the people who are delivering direct services to the public and less to an information technology professional. So I was very, very pleased with that, and I felt that that is a great recognition of the government for my services, and I felt very honored and privileged. The other highlights, I have many highlights. The other highlight, of course, was to join my current firm, KPMG. And again, I was a CIO in the government department. One fine day, I decided that I had I've reached to wherever I need to in my career with the government. And I took up a job in Sydney from Brisbane. I did not know anything about the job. I had a fairly large team. I went there into KPMG as a one-man team. And again, over the last 10 years, I built my career up again from bottom up, becoming a director and partner, and eventually becoming a regional leader and then running the business. So that is that whole experience was quite an incredible experience, only because I met with so many wonderful people. And again, I would say the highlight of just working with so many people and learning so much from these people is a key success factor in my career. So I would say that, again, that is something which I will always remember, and I'm continuing to do so right now as well. So I would say these are some of the highlights, Stephen, as far as my career concerned. And, of course, coming to India recently, about 18 months back again, After living in Australia for almost 20 years, we said, "Okay, let us explore the new territory." I've never worked in India except 1 year, almost 20 years back, and India was a completely unknown region and country for me. And my wife and I, we decided that we will spend some time in India. And again, this experience of working in India in an emerging economy, a hyper-growth market, is proving out to be an outstanding experience. And again, I would say that is going to be remembered by me as again one of the highlights of my career over the last 20 years or so. Now, in terms of valuable lessons, there's only one thing I would say. Which I've learned, of course, there are many lessons I've learned about technology and implementation and how to run a business and so on and so forth. But one of the lessons which I would never forget is that for any business, people are its more important asset. And if a leader can connect with his people, then he will be able to run an organization successfully. And if he or she are not unable to connect with the people, no matter what he does and how smart he is and whatever he can do, it will not just happen. And I realize that the human connect is the most important, valuable lesson I learned in my career over the last two decades.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the human connection, because you do lead a team of about, 2,500 people in the KPMG India, and then you're EMA IT advisory practice has something like, 3,500 people?
That's correct, yes. So we have a fairly large team, and as you know, KPMG itself is a large organization, 140,000 people. And when you have large teams, it becomes extremely important that you're able to communicate and connect with them so that you are able to motivate your team to move in a certain direction, but more importantly, contribute to the growth and progression of the organization. And human connect, again, is an important, extremely important factor in successful achievement of these objectives.
You know, earlier you mentioned winning the Leadership Excellence Award from the Queensland government, and you've also won the CIORC Outstanding Contribution Award, and the ACS Honorary Life Membership Award, and you're the 45th recipient of that award since the formation of the society. So it's sort of a rare achievement, and there are many, many others. Which recognition are you most proud of, and why?
Stephen, I would say that I've been fortunate to get all these awards, and I'm very proud of every single recognition that has been bestowed on me by my colleagues, by the industry, and people whom I've known. I was very surprised when I got this award recently at the World Computer Congress. I was never expecting it to become 45th Australian to ever receive this award. So I just feel that I've been lucky, I've been very fortunate, and I'm very grateful that people have felt that I'm worthy of these awards. The most important part that I would like to say is I'm very grateful for these awards, but I've always enjoyed the journey and I'll continue to enjoy the journey, and I will cherish whatever rewards and awards come my way. But I'm focusing on the journey, and I want to make sure that the journey remains as enjoyable as it is possible.
You know, you talked about the tremendous growth in India, your practice going at something like 50%. And so that kind of, you know, wants me to sort of drill further. You know, can you share additional insights on India and the IT industry?
Sure, Stephen. As I mentioned to you, I've been here now 18 months, and it's one of the most exciting markets of the world. And the technology industry itself has been growing at a tremendous pace, and it's almost now an $80 billion industry in India. And the government now in the last 12 to 18 months has announced massive reforms, and has agreed to spend a fair bit of money, some funds, on building IT infrastructure. So India is going through a phase of massive investment in infrastructure by the government, and there are several states who are setting up infrastructure facilities, and billions of dollars are going into it. Very importantly, Stephen, the major players of the IT industry have continued to post good profits even during the global financial crisis. So the Indian economy turned out to be so resilient that in spite of a negative growth in many countries and no growth in several other countries, the industry, IT industry in India and other industries as well, they grew, they survived the crisis, and they are now in hyper growth mode. I use the word hyper growth. So anything about 20% growth, in my view, is hyper growth. So if you're growing at 50%, that is hyper growth. So they're all in that growth mode, and this country has some extraordinary strengths, if I can say so, as far as its talent pool is concerned. I have seen some of the most smart and most resilient and hardworking individuals in India than I've seen anywhere else. And I think that is the strength of this great country, and that is what makes the IT industry and other industries very, very successful. And I have no doubt in my mind that the way India is going, it will continue to remain a global force in the IT space, and will become a major contributor not only to many businesses around the world in terms of helping them grow, but also significantly helping the qualities of lives of people in all parts of the world, both Western and Eastern countries all around the world. So India is right now is in an excellent growth mode. President Obama was here recently, and he made a statement saying that India is actually not an emerging country. India has emerged already. I thought that was a great statement to be made by a president. So again, people like myself, we all feel very fortunate that we are in a country that is seeing the growth, there is so much of vitality, there is so much of excitement and enthusiasm everywhere you go. And of course, there are so many opportunities that one can work on, and to be able to work in such an environment again is a great privilege. So I'm very, very happy that I'm able to experience this experience and whatever is happening in India at this point of time.
Kumar, you are recognized as one of the top leaders in the world. And so you're perfectly positioned to talk about leadership in emerging markets or emerged markets. Can you sort of make some comments?
Yes, I have. Again, it's very kind of you to say that I'm being recognized as one of the leaders, top leaders of the world. I've been learning how to lead people for some time now, and I continue to learn. When I look at some of the very successful leaders, I talk to them, and I see how they're managing people, how they're running their business. I continue to learn from them. Having said that, I found that there is a very clear difference between a developed country, leadership in a developed or a mature country like Australia and the United States and United Kingdom and Germany, and a leadership in an emerging country or a country that is, we call it a developing country like India, where there are lots of people who are still quite poor as such. As far as the leadership is concerned, we tend to take a little bit more structured approach in developed countries. We have well-defined paradigms, and we follow the philosophies and the models that have been introduced over several years. But coming to India, I found that leadership needs to take a different meaning in terms of organization and its people. In an emerging country or an emerging economy like India, where there are lots of young people, it's very important that the leadership aspects take into consideration the need to be able to connect with these people at every level possible, from senior management to at the entry level or at the beginning level. In India, there is a lot of importance that is given to role models. There are people who are willing to look at the leaders and follow them. Young people are always looking for guidance. They're all looking for coaching and mentoring. So therefore, it's extremely important being a leader in India to be able to have all those qualities and all those skills and all those behaviors that can motivate the people who are working with you. I learned that to be a very, very important lesson, that if you are not good enough as far as whether your values are concerned or behaviors are concerned, it'll be more difficult to be a leader in a country like India than elsewhere. And again, leadership is something that is changing on a very regular basis, because the needs of the business are changing and the needs of the people are changing. And again, I felt that ability to adapt to changing situations, ability to connect with people, ability to inspire and motivate them, and basically help them become successful in the journey of their professional life could be a very rewarding experience. And that is what I'm finding in my leadership role in India. And I'm thoroughly enjoying doing whatever I'm doing, Stephen.
Kumar, you're also recognized as a thought leader in the whole area of professionalism in computing and in business and technology and so on. So I'd like to really see your views on that. What about professionalism in ICT, and what is it?
Professionalism, I've been an advocate of professionalism for quite some time, and for very several years now, because ICT is a profession that is there everywhere. The word professionalism invokes images of highly qualified, trained and concerned individuals working to serve the needs of the community and businesses. Professionalism is beyond qualifications. It's about creating and maintaining a culture where there are high ethical standards and values, where the skills are regularly updated and validated, where there is a regular exchange of information and ideas, and there's accountability and responsibility for actions. If you look at the dependence that we have on ICT, no matter which industry we come from, you will very quickly come to a conclusion, Stephen, that ICT professionalism is mandatory to have a successful business or a successful industry. And I've been a great advocate of professionalism for several years in ICT in several roles I've taken up.
I guess that's a natural segue then to this additional sort of thinking, and that is your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like medicine and law with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, and globally recognized credentials.
Yeah. This takes us to another aspect of a profession, and that is into regulation and licensing of ICT professionals. Just like we regulate the doctors and the lawyers and the engineers. As far as the regulation of ICT professionals are concerned, several attempts have been made so far, and well-known professional bodies like IEEE, ACM, and others, they've all tried to do this. But a very important aspect of this bringing in professionalism is the governments to recognize that ICT is one of the most important professions in the business world today. And unless they introduce measures as they have introduced for other professions, so for example, you would not allow doctors to treat patients without proper medical qualifications. But still very surprising that we allow computer professionals to handle highly sensitive medical equipment without properly checking on them, and sometimes the lives of the people, patients in the hospitals, could be at risk if any of these computer-based equipments fail. So it's very interesting to see that doctors are required to have well-trained and regulated credentials, whereas the same requirement doesn't exist for ICT professionals. And for example, even in the airline industry, as you can see, if computer systems don't work, it could actually cost lives. So what we're saying here is that professionalism is very important. Regulation is very important. And the governments around the world should embrace regulation of ICT profession as a risk mitigation strategy.
You know, there is this program called IP3, which is part of a UN-sanctioned body. And IP3 stands for International Professional Practice Partnership. So what can you tell us about this program and what kind of value it provides?
IP3 is a great program, and it has taken almost 4 years of work, as you know, Stephen, when in Chile at the World Computer Congress, the IFIP formed a task force, and the Australian Computer Society was a part of that task force with the British Computer Society and the Canadian Computer Society and IEEE and IFIP. And the task force deliberated and concluded on its work, as you're well aware of, and created this IP3 program. And since it was agreed in 2007, IP3 program has now been executed in a number of countries. IP3, in my view, is the only professional IT standard that we have with relevant accreditation policies and procedures that can be applied globally in the ICT industry. I also very much believe that the computer professional status accreditation is a great qualification that IP3 provides, which allows, again, to reduce risk in the industry as far as ICT professionals are concerned. I also believe that it is very important that all the industry bodies and trade bodies around the world, they embrace IP3 as
a set of standards that they should aim to comply with, and help create professional standard committees to take all the good work that is coming out of IP3 and use for improvement of professionalism in the ICT industry globally. And I think it's a great outcome that we have the work that is happening in IP3.
You mentioned IFIP, and I should explain to the audience that IFIP is the International Federation for Information Processing, which was formed 50 years ago as a UN UNESCO sanctioned body. In fact, they're the official consultative body for ICT by UNESCO. So I should mention that, and IP3 is part of this UN body. Where do you see CIOs in the future?
The roles of the CIOs has changed quite a bit over the last 15 years or so, and it continues to change, Stephen, as you know. The CIO has come a long way, and we need to recognize that the CIOs have got one of the most challenging jobs in any organization. Increasingly, in these times, we are seeing that the CIOs need to become more and more business orientated, and their ability to develop greater business skills and communication skills is going to determine their success. They're increasingly required to build close relationships with the CEOs and CFOs so that they can help them drive the organizational agenda. And in many developed countries, we are seeing that CIOs are going through huge challenges as far as their own budgets are concerned, and therefore innovation has taken a very high priority in the CIO's agenda, and they're increasingly required to help organizations grow in a fairly difficult environment and come up with innovative ways of helping those organizations that they're serving grow. So CIOs are also increasingly putting on the hat of chief innovation officers. And as you can see, what I've explained to you, the role of CIOs is becoming more and more diverse. And you can see that CIOs are increasingly contributing to directly running of the business. And I think that is the way the direction is going right now.
I guess that kind of reminds me of this IT capability maturity framework that came out of Dublin, I guess, or out of Ireland. And it's all about sort of IT very much supporting the business side and in fact, having measurable metrics that prove that there's going to be increase on the business goals and the business objectives. And I guess CIOs are much more aligned in this way than ever before.
Correct. Absolutely.
It's interesting to note, too, that next year there's the IFIP World CIO Forum, the first of its kind, that is going to be held in November of 2011, hosted in China. And that would be an interesting forum in that you'll have over 1,000 CIOs from around the world and CEOs collaborating and to even drive this forward even further. So I'm sort of looking forward to that next year. Kumar, how do we enable innovation? You talked about CIOs really being chief innovation officers. So how do we enable that?
It's a very, very good question, Stephen. As a matter of fact, only yesterday, I was chairing a CEO roundtable of some of the very eminent and well-known CEOs of Indian industry for CNBC. And the topic was enabling innovation for growth. What these individuals had to say was quite remarkable. There are organizations that have significantly increased their research and development investment over the last 12 to 24 months when their business is actually going down as far as their growth and profitability is concerned. And I felt that that was quite a remarkable thing to learn. The first thing someone would do when an organization is facing economic pressures is to cut down all discretionary expenditure. Many examples of successful organizations have shown that when the going gets tough, they actually increase their spending on R&D and innovation. So I think one of the most important things to enable innovation is to make it a priority and make it a part of the value system of the organization. The second very important requirement of fostering innovation is that organizations should allow their staff to make mistakes, to fail, and learn from those mistakes. If we don't allow people to do that, there will not be much innovation because everyone will be kind of playing very, very safe. The third requirement, in my view, is that organizations need to continue to remain connected with their ecosystems, with their customers, their suppliers, their shareholders, and others. And they need to, through that interaction, innovate solutions, innovate new ways of doing business. And by the way, the term used for this is social innovation. And again, that's extremely important to create a very healthy, innovative environment, enable that environment to help the organization grow. And last but not the least, again, it's very important that as innovative ideas and innovative IT outcomes are originating in an organization, the leadership of that organization is capturing them, whether it is in form of patents or papers or whatever it is, and giving appropriate level of recognition to these very, very smart individuals, because nothing helps much more than a sincere appreciation, motivation to inspire these people who are innovating. And I believe that these are three or four things that an organization can do to enable innovation. And again, it's very important as the world is changing right now, with a lot of business moving to east, the financial crisis still dampening the growth rate in many developed countries, that innovation takes a topmost priority in almost every business's agenda, and the CEOs and their teams are working on how to come up with innovative ways of serving their customers and continue to flourish in this market.
I'm just thinking that we are at an historical inflection point, in that for the first time, we have the coming together of various bodies, including the International Federation of Information Processing through their IP3 program, and launching a global profession. In fact, this implementation started in 2009, though from the initial meetings beginning in 2007. And it's noteworthy to say that the Australian Computer Society was actually the first accredited society worldwide in this program to create an IT profession, so a significant achievement. And you were part of that achievement. And there's value in members joining or IT professionals joining professional societies and contributing in the creation of the profession as we go forward. But what are some of the other values of or value of being involved in professional societies?
That's a very good question, Stephen. I was the chairman of the Australian Computer Society when the society was recognized for its professional work and awarded. A membership in a professional society offers individuals an opportunity to support and be actively involved in research, communication, and personal development programs in their chosen field. They are a part of a community rather than being individual. Being a part of that community helps them to learn from each other, learn from the experiences of each other, and so on and so forth. It allows people to network with leaders in the industry, thereby helping them enhance significantly career opportunities. If you look at just ACS, there are so many people who have been very active in ACS, but as a result, been able to meet with some of the movers and the shakers of the industry, and been able to build relationships, and been able to then further progress in their careers due to those relationships. The third very important value, I believe, is to an opportunity for professionals to become a part of the ecosystem and contribute towards driving of the profession and building up professionalism. One of the biggest motivating factors for me for being a part of ACS for more than a decade was that I was in the forefront of the profession, contributing to a development of standards as far as that profession is concerned, interacting with leaders of the profession. I was able to influence the thinking of the government, lobby for certain initiatives, both in the industry with the government and the academia that will help the profession, and was able to ultimately influence the national direction through my interactions with the minister, the prime minister, the premiers, and so on and so forth. And that is a great privilege, again, to be able to do all those sorts of things that I've explained. And had I not been a part of a professional society like ACS, I would have never, ever been able to do this just as an individual. So, as you can see, being a part of a professional society, there are great benefits. It adds significant value. It enhances an individual's leadership capabilities. And very importantly, I think we should take this as a moral obligation, because this is a profession like ICT or whichever you want to pick. The profession has been very kind to us. It has helped us to earn our livelihood. We have built very successful careers. Our families are very happy. We had very good experiences, both from a work point of view and a life point of view. And one of the ways that we can thank is to join a professional society and give something back to the community. That is what a professional society provides us. It provides us with an opportunity to do so.
Well, Kumar, we're getting down to the last few questions here, and I'm going to now tap into your global status as one of the best thinkers out there and one of the top leaders in that. Can you provide some of your top predictions for future trends and then your implications and opportunities?
Sure. From my perspective, the trend which is emerging right now, Stephen, and there is a certain degree of bias because I'm sitting in India right now, is that India and China will very soon be known as one of the biggest consumers of information technology services and products in the world. And therefore, these two countries are going to become one of the most important locations or regions for all global businesses to focus on. Many of them are already focusing. Some of them are thinking about it. But let me tell you, if people don't have an India, if businesses don't have an India strategy and a China strategy, and people are not thinking about doing business with these countries, then they need to very seriously think about the future of this business. So that's how it is becoming. The second trend which I'm seeing, and there's a lot of talk, is the potential of cloud computing. I believe that the cloud offers tremendous benefits to businesses and individuals in a very cost-effective manner. And the potential of the cloud is now, we can see that through various solutions that are available in the market. And as the time progresses over the next 5 years, I very strongly believe that cloud is going to take a very high priority in the business strategy of many organizations. The third trend that I'm seeing and will continue to grow is technology convergence, which is communication, television, broadband, internet, all of them all being packaged in various forms and being shipped onto various gadgets like mobile phones, iPads, Blackberries, kiosks, whatever you name it. So technology convergence is going to be a trend that will continue to evolve and will, as a result, change the way we experience some of the things like music, access information, and all other things that we are doing right now. The fourth trend, which will continue to, I believe, have significant growth and will continue to have a major place in the organization strategy, is the sustainability and green IT part of information technology. Again, I see that whole industry growing significantly. I was reading an interview by Vinod Tam in the Economic Times just a few days back. Vinod is actually he's a founder, and in fact he was the one who invented the Pentium chip. And he was saying that in olden days when he invented the chip, the requirement was that you invent a chip that is as small as possible and is as fast as it can work. Now, he very much believes that the trend is going to be not only the size and the speed, but would it be environmentally sustainable? That is, can this chip take as little power as possible and still continue to work? Now, that is a very interesting dimension. I believe that every single product that is going to come out into the marketplace will have the sustainability aspect attached to it, and its success will depend upon some of these things. So that will be another trend that will only continue to grow. And last but not least, I would say there will be a huge change in the way people will continue to interact each other with each other, and social networking will get into organizations in a big way. And even though many organizations are not using, I can tell you social networking will become a very dominant part of business strategy going forward. It will become a part of recruitment strategy, it'll be part of communication strategy, and it will just be, it will become the medium through which businesses improve productivity and achieve their objectives. So there are five trends, as I mentioned to you, cloud computing, sustainability, technology convergence, social networking, and RFID and automatic data capture.
To find out more, what are your top recommended resources and why?
I have access to a large pool of resources, Stephen, in my role. Of course, I use the analysts, well-known analysts, that come out with their reports. But as a KPMG partner, I would recommend KPMG thought leadership all over the world that comes out in 140 countries. And businesses have found those resources to be of incredible value for their growth and progress. Other than that, I find resources coming out of Harvard Business School, Australian Institute of Management, Australian Institute of Company Directors, and many other well-known organizations should be very, very helpful. So there's no single resource center, if I can name. I use several sources, Stephen. And again, for anyone who is a seeker of knowledge, they'll very quickly know where to go to if they do their research. And I think we should continue to search new sources to gain knowledge.
I'm just thinking I could add the fact that in your region, the Australian Computer Society is a great repository for knowledge and information and expertise and also insights into the profession itself.
Yes, we have, so thank you for mentioning that. We have a large number of completely qualified and very experienced members, close to 16,000. And we use the talent of these individuals as resources to help help the community and many times help businesses as well. So it's a great point, and we continue to aspire to be valuable to the community and our members.
And also in September, you recently hosted the Olympics of Computing, which is the World Computer Congress, which was held in Brisbane, Australia in September. But the website itself and the Australian Computer Society website contains videos and podcasts and papers from the myriad of presentations that were given at the World Computer Congress.
Yes, we have a lot of information there on the ACS website, and Stephen, we were very, very fortunate to attract very talented individuals to WCC, including people like yourself, CEOs of many organizations, well-known CIOs like the United Kingdom government CIO, and many other people. And all that information is available on the website, and anyone who is interested can access this. I personally gained a great deal by just interacting with these people and listening to what they had to say at the World Computer Congress.
I think I was struck by the fact that the UK CIO is managing something like a $29 billion budget, U.S., and he says that professionalism is a key element in terms of how they do their work and what they look for in terms of IT service providers. So, again, this whole concept that you talked about, professionalism and, you know, ensuring quality and standards and much more.
Yes, in fact, for the government's business, professionalism is very, very important because the national security is sometimes dependent on making sure that you have the suitably qualified people being able to support your objectives and help you achieve those objectives. And, you know, some of these roles and jobs are highly sensitive. And again, professionalism and having the right criteria to determine who is a professional, who is and who is not, helps government agencies and governments around the world to address the risks associated with getting wrong people in.
And for those societies, or I should say those professionals out there looking for their local professional society in their region, they can go to the ifip.org site and look at their particular national society that they can join in their region, whether it's in Europe, in the Middle East, Africa, whether it's in the different countries in the APAC region or in the NORAM region or Latin America and so on. There's a number of societies from around the world, all of which are members of the IFIP Federation. And they can look at those societies to find that means of connection and to sort of build a profession. Well, we're down to our last few questions. And I know that you do a lot of traveling, Kumar, and you encounter amazing people throughout your work because you yourself are a remarkable individual. So you must have a story, one or more, to share, maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing from your work.
Yes, I would like to share a number of stories with you, but I'll pick this one for you, Stephen. I've been traveling quite extensively around the world for the last 5 years, and for most of that time, I've been traveling anywhere from 7 to 10 days, and I've traveled to all remote parts of the world. But I had an interesting experience and this has nothing to do with IT or business. I mean, I just want to share this with you because it's one of those things that happened to me and I continue to remember, and I share this with my friends, and is that I took a flight from Chicago to Los Angeles, and in the first class, and the person right beside me ended up to be a very successful producer in Hollywood. And he only took that particular flight up because he had a very scary experience just previously flying his own plane or whatever, and he was involved in some sort of a situation. So he started flying commercial airlines, and I was fortunate enough to sit beside him on a two-hour flight. And during that experience, he explained to me how the movie business in Hollywood works, and it was very similar to the business that people do in venture capital business. And I learned about that. And on that flight, we built up a good relationship, 2 hours chatting about things. And as the time progressed, we continued to maintain contacts. And as a result of that, over the last few years, he introduced me to many well-known Hollywood personalities and these wonderful actors who we see in movies. Had it not been for my job, I had not been traveling Chicago to Los Angeles, I would have never met with this this gentleman, and he's now become a great friend, and it's one of those things, you know, I've met so many well-known people from all over the world, including from Hollywood, and again, this has got nothing to do with my profession, but just that chance coincidence of sitting on the plane with somebody enabled me to meet with some extremely talented and well-known individuals in Hollywood, in the movie industry. And I tell this story to people who say that you never know what is coming your way, and you need to be always out there looking, building to build relationship and see what you can do in the present moment. Not in the future, not in the past. You need to live in the present moment.
And I guess it goes back to one of the original sort of foundational statements that you made earlier, and that is about making connections and always looking for opportunities to make connections.
That's right. Absolutely.
And also the importance of people and working with people.
Yes, there's nothing much more important than an individual. And I always believed that it's not business, it's not profit, it's not systems, not technology. If you have human beings involved in any situation or transaction, you just have to make it a point that you treat them with the importance, at most importance. Everything else then falls into place.
Now, you've encountered a lot of people. You have many personal relationships and business relationships throughout the world. You have a remarkable career spanning continents and great roles that you've done. You've had global impact, historical impact in terms of the initiatives that you've been working on. Are there some career tips that you can provide to the ICT professional out there from your life experiences?
Sure, Stephen, I have learned a lot of things in my career over the last 20 years, and the tips which I am going to provide are no different to ICT industry than any other industry. So what I mean, they are universally, the principles that I'm going to talk about are universally applicable. And so one of the principles that I've already articulated is that of making sure that there is human connect, people connect. It's extremely important that all professionals are looking for ways of interacting with people and remain connected and building relationships. I believe that that has been one of my most important principles in life, and I've followed that, and I've never regretted. I've now not only have many friends, but I've got many professional relationships all over the world at different kinds of levels. The other important principles that I have learned over the years is that it's extremely important to remain positive. You know, life, in life you come across many challenges, you face them on a daily basis, but positive thinking and trying to not get overwhelmed with negativity or circumstances that are not favorable is one very important way of continuing to progress in the career. The third thing that I always believe in is that it's very important for people to be able to feel the need to learn. You know, unless people have that motivation and that aspiration to learn, because you can never learn enough. So as the world is changing, I think people need to, people who want to be successful, who want to grow, and growing is just not in terms of, material wealth, if I say so, like, you know, increasing your bank balance and all that's important. Financial wealth is important. But also growing in terms of wisdom, maturity, ability to, you know, look at the situation and deal with those situations, that is all also growing. So again, that's very important. So people need to look at that. And other things which I always say to people is that, you know, it's very important for one to have a very clear view in the mind as to what they want to do. It is just simply not enough to, I use the word, be a leaf in the wind. That means that you can go in any direction the wind blows. It doesn't work. If you want to be a successful professional, you need to be a successful professional in your mind before you become a successful professional in reality. So again, that is very important. Just sorting out, what do you want to be? How does the success look like? How do you want to contribute to the world? You know, you need to have a very, very strong purpose for whatever you do. And it is, and purpose, if the purpose of that individual is only like, look, my purpose is to just go get a better job, it is a short-term purpose. So people need to start thinking about what is the purpose of their career or profession, and how do they contribute how do they want to contribute back to the community? So these are some of the things which I constantly think about, I believe in, and I believe any professional who wants to grow ICT, in ICT or any other area needs to look at some of these things, and if they embrace some of these principles, I think they will be very, very successful.
Kumar, you're a very eclectic person with a diverse background and many kinds of insights in just an innumerable number of areas. And we've covered a lot of questions, but I'm going to turn the tables now. Are there some questions that we've missed? So what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
I think one of the things, Stephen, I don't know whether your listeners would be interested or not, there has been a lot of discussion about outsourcing off late, and I have commented extensively in the media because I'm the global head for outsourcing for KPMG, and even countries like United States, there were quite a few statements made by the politicians about protectionism and the need to reduce outsourcing. So one of my questions would be, you know, with the growing calls for protectionism in developed countries where they are still going through recession, my question would be, what do you think of the future of the outsourcing industry? And the answer to this question is that outsourcing has now become economic reality. Businesses in US and UK and other countries are critically dependent on outsourcing their requirements effectively to meet their customer needs and deliver on their business objectives and remain viable. So irrespective of whatever the politicians may say, outsourcing will continue to remain an area of growth and a very important area of strategic importance to businesses all over the world. And I don't see much of an impact happening from any statements that are coming out about protecting jobs or protecting governments from spending on outsourcing and so on and so forth. So I feel that there will be very little change. The question I would like to ask is, we hear a lot of stories about India growing and making great progress, but what are its challenges that will prevent India from becoming one of the significant players on the in the global scene? And India is, the answer to that question would be, Stephen, that India is emerging right now. It's growing at a phenomenal rate. While India has got strong leaders, its political systems are more transparent and accountable, and it improves on its infrastructure, and that it creates businesses that are sustainable and long-term, not just short-term, India will only remain as a promise and may not become the reality unless some of these things are looked at. So again, a great opportunity, great growth that the country is growing through. But what happens in the next 5 years in this country in terms of its leadership, in terms of its people, in terms of its political system, in terms of its professionalism, very importantly, Stephen, you know, this professionalism is a huge issue in India. And again, programs like IFIP, you know, if they're introduced, bring in significant benefits to the people in this country. So having those professional standards, just again, not only in ICT, but every single area, healthcare, education, all that, very much needed for this country to continue to deliver on the promise and potential it offers. So those are the two questions I would have liked to answer. And if there's anything else, Stephen, I'm very happy to add.
Well, you've taken us on a remarkable journey, Kumar, and we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions. And we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and deep insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I feel very fortunate to be able to talk to you and answer these questions. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Kumar Parakala, KPMG Head of IT Advisory, EMA in India, Chief Operating Officer, Advisory India, an internationally renowned innovator and senior executive.